KBTC, a viewer-supported community service of Bates Technical College.
From KBTC Public Television Studios in Tacoma, Washington, it's the Northwest Now podcast. Each week, we take a closer look at the people and issues that affect all of us here in Western Washington. So sit back, relax, and join the conversation with your host, Tom Lason.
If you remember 1976, and viewers of this program almost certainly do, it's been 50 years since our last birthday blowout for the good old U.S. of A. Now we're doing it again, and part of it includes Ken Burns' new series, The American Revolution. We're talking with local historian and Northwest Now regular Michael Sullivan about what life was like in Western Washington 250 years ago. Representatives from the Daughters of the American Revolution and the Living History Association are here to preview plans for a year of celebration. And our Steve Kiggins with the story of local ties to the celebration of American Revolutionary history. America at 250 is the focus next on Northwest Now. Just about every state and historical organization inside the states worked for more than a year preparing for the celebration of America's 250th birthday in 2026. Here on the West Coast, celebrating America at 250 is a little complicated. The Revolutionary War happened 3,000 miles to the east, long before Lewis and Clark, before the Western expansion, or before statehood was even contemplated. But of course, local indigenous peoples were living their lives like they had for countless generations, and the area was in the process of being discovered by people from Europe. Let's talk about it now with historian Michael Sullivan. Michael, great to have you back on Northwest Now. We really appreciate your contribution over the years, and I want to thank you personally and publicly for all you've done for Northwest Now when it comes to matters of history. Talk a little bit about what was life like around here prior to 1776, which is kind of the key date we're looking at.
Yeah. Well, you know, the maps were starting to be made and the world was starting to know about itself. But in our part of the world, some of the last shoreline maps in the world were going to be made along this kind of coast from California up to Alaska. So very little was known outside of the geography of the Pacific Northwest. But by that time, there were very sophisticated independent sovereign nations that were
sniffing around,
the equivalent of the 13 colonies along our coast, with distinct indigenous groups who had their own sophisticated languages, separate languages, absolutely incredible knowledge, empirical knowledge of the world around them, and languages that were developed enough in complexity that for societies that kept all of their memory and everything in the oral tradition, those languages carried the intellectual weight of a profound understanding of the natural world.
And who I was talking about, I thought you were heading us to sniffing around by the major powers of the world, the Spanish and the British. But they were starting to poke around here on this coast a little bit. What was driving their search? There's an enigma out there that they were looking for. Talk a little bit about what was driving that.
Well, you get into the 18th century, into the end of the 1700s, actually the middle of the 1700s, and there was a curiosity by the powers. We were shifting from this land of kings and armies to an intellectual world. We call it the Enlightenment. And there was a real curiosity about the physical world, the natural world. There were scientists and astronomers that were, and artists before photography, that were traveling on this exploration. So for example, Peter the Great in Russia is actually puzzled by the fact, is North America connected with Asia? And so we have Vitus Bering in 1741 going up and proving through his journey this preceding Cook and the British, but the Russians coming down from the north and beginning to map the coast.
But all the what I was pointing you at was a lot of this energy was the search for the Northwest Passage. That was the big enigma.
That was the big the big puzzle. Yeah. Once the world had been circumnavigated, the big obstacle between the East and the West was the continents of the Americas. And where do you get across there? And so this mythic, elusive idea of a Northwest Passage becomes just the holy grail for the European powers especially.
Talk a little bit about Captain Cook, his story. He's a name that, even if you don't follow history, you'll recognize Captain Cook.
You'll recognize Captain Cook.
Yeah.
You have to. He's the great explorer, the great the great investigator, the great student of the globe. He just really, in three voyages, all the way from England, going all the way around the world, mapping, drawing in, probably filling in more maps of the world than any other explorer of his age or even since. And the British were unique in that they published their maps to the world, whereas a lot of the other countries that were more militaristic tended to keep their maps strategically kind of silent.
Yeah.
But Cook quickly got back. And, you know, a guy goes off like on a moonshot from England, and, you know, 2 years later he comes back and he's for the first time exhibiting a kangaroo. Or talking about civilizations, you know, around the world, and it's spellbinding.
Yeah.
To the English people and to the world, really.
What do we know? Do we know what the first contact was among the indigenous populations with white explorers? I mean, do we know anything about that?
Well, we contact with the outside world. I have to think about the Northwest Coast. These are maritime people.
Yeah.
In big vessels that are blue water sailors, even though they're not using sails. And the first contact with the outside world, probably with Asians, probably with Japanese or even Chinese that are blown with the eastward moving weather. Europeans, we don't know exactly, and it was probably accidental, and it probably happens 1400s, maybe.
Yeah, and apparently there was, some confrontation with the Connaughts. There were some small skirmishes early on prior to a more robust exploration
of
the area.
And we need to remember the Russians coming down from the north. Spanish, once they get into the Pacific, are coming up from California. And then the English and even Portuguese and some of the other countries.
So even though this area didn't really experience the revolution per se, and it kind of wasn't a thing out here, what are the implications of the revolution for the eventual exploration and opening up of this area? Even though we weren't in that, or this area wasn't in that, it was still affected by it. Talk a little bit about that.
You know, this is a bad categorization of historians, but there are those that are political and military and kind of colonial power kind of group. And then there are historians that look at history more from an environmental and a scientific way. Mm-hmm. I think the conflict between Britain and the Americas during the American Revolution are on the East Coast, are largely in that political conflict kind of history.
Yeah.
When you think about the Northwest at the same time, it's the same players. It's the Americans and the British encountering indigenous cultures, but it's more in the realm of environment and science.
Yeah.
This is the Age of Enlightenment, where the idea of inherited kings and empire are being kind of put aside by the scientists and the thinkers. And the more information that's collected about the physical world, the more it supports the Enlightenment. And the amount of new information that was delivered from the Pacific Northwest into the Enlightenment is really amazing.
30 years later, we get Lewis and Clark, and then the rest is history, as you might say. Here come the Europeans and the Americans after the formation. And I think my last question to you is, why does 1776 matter? What's your big thought on that? And do you have any hopes for this coming year of celebrations? Do you hope we come together? Do you hope it's unifying in some way? I don't want to put words in your mouth. Where are you?
Well, I think we need to remember that not too long we become part of America, but our part of the world is still part of what's going on. Benjamin Franklin writes a letter to the captains in the American Navy saying, "Don't molest Cook, leave him alone." That how you play that game as a historian. I wonder if so and so ever met somebody else from history. I wonder if Benjamin Franklin ever met Captain Cook, because they were contemporaries. They were both in London at various times at the same time. But there is a connection here for us in the Northwest. We are relevant to the period of the American Revolution. So it is part, very much part of our history here in the Pacific Northwest. And we're part of the American story during that period, our part of the world.
Mm-hmm. Michael, I appreciate your time and your insight on this. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks, Tom.
Well, the Pacific Northwest was out of sight and out of mind in 1776. As Steve Kiggins tells us, that's not stopping local celebrations and examinations of revolutionary history.
On a country highway in Oregon's Marion County, you'll find horses grazing along the roadside. Fewer than 500 call this small town of St. Paul home. It's about halfway between Portland and Salem in the Willamette Valley. St. Paul is famous for its summertime rodeo and the final resting place for one of America's original patriots.
This is the only known patriot that's buried in the Pacific Northwest.
David Witter says the Oregon Sons of the American Revolution annually leaves a wreath at William Cannon's headstone inside the St. Paul Pioneer Cemetery to honor Cannon's service and highlight connection to community.
They were instrumental in forcing Cornwallis to return up north. It's the Overmountain men that were involved with that are the same kind of people that were the fur traders that came to the West Coast.
Witter says researchers believe Cannon fought for America's independence in South Carolina in the 1780s, before joining an expedition to establish Fort Astoria in 1811. History shows Cannon then moved westward to work for the Hudson's Bay Company at Fort Vancouver, where his tradecraft is recreated by volunteers like Baltasar Puig.
He would have recognized this place. He's the Forrest Gump of his time. He managed to go through every major event of his lifetime being unnoticed. And I think there's some humility there that it just speaks volumes.
Researchers say Cannon settled in French Prairie near Champouy, where he joined a majority among pioneers voting to establish the Provisional Government of Oregon in the early 1840s. That vote later visualized in this 1923 Theodore Gigot painting titled The Inception of the Birth of Oregon. Near center frame, standing next to fellow pioneer Joseph Meek, viewers peer over the shoulder of the nearly 90-year-old Cannon, his long white hair and white beard showing his age, as if Cannon's long and storied past leads us to a moment that offers a vision towards a future for the American Pacific Northwest that is all but inevitable.
Well, it's fulfilling. It tells you who you are and what your family went through in order for you to be where you are. And that's important.
In Marion County, Oregon, Steve Kiggins, Northwest Now.
A side note now for just a moment. I hope you've had a chance to see Ken Burns' 6-part series, The American Revolution. If not, it will air from time to time right here on KBTC. And for those of you who are members, you can see it on PBS Passport. Sign up on our website at kbtc.org. Joining us now to talk more about the celebration of America's 250th birthday are Renee Crist with Tacoma's Mary Ball chapter of the Daughters of the American Revolution, and Dennis Lawler and Walter Beauchamp with Thurston County's The Spirit of 76 Living History Association. Welcome all of you to Northwest Now. Great to have a conversation about America 250. It's going to be a heck of a celebration. I'm glad to have Daughters of the American Revolution and the Spirit of 76 Living History Association here for this. Let's start with a little bit about your organizations. Renee, Daughters of the American Revolution, DAR, I heard it a lot growing up. Talk a little bit about what it is and who's in it and how folks can get involved if they want to.
Well, the Daughters of the American Revolution was founded in 1890, and we're housed actually headquarters is in Washington, D.C., right across, really, really near to the White House. And when it was formed in 1890, the women that were forming it were really concerned about us losing history and losing our knowledge about the Revolution and our founding of the country. So they formed this organization. And it is currently 190,000 members, about 3,000 chapters all over the country and some overseas as well, and not overseas, but in other countries like Canada as well. And in Washington State, which is really interesting, is that our chapter, I'm the vice regent of the Mary Ball chapter here in Tacoma. It was formed in 1894, just 4 years later. So you think about that. You're here in Washington, yeah. D.C., and all the way across the nation, we have a brand new chapter forming in Washington State. And we have been continuously operating since 1894. We have in Washington, the Washington State Society now has 35 chapters, and encompasses about 3,000 members. And the chapters are all over the state of Washington. All of us have America 250 chairmen. We have committees for so many things we do within the community. So it's not just about our, the one thing that ties us all together is that we all are related to someone who gave aid, fought, or did something during the American Revolution, which founded our country. So that's our main core. But historic preservation, patriotism, and education is our.
When we come back around to you, I want to ask you about how people can figure that out, because it's not just a thing, hey, I'm going to sign up and do it. No. So we'll talk about that in a minute. Dennis, talk a little bit about the Spirit of 76 Living History Association.
Right. So the Spirit of 76 Living History, we're based in Washington State. We're a nonprofit here in the state, where most of our members are on the western side of the mountains. Some of us are, like Walter and I are both grew up in Boston, so we kind of have an affinity to this history.
Yeah.
But there's a strong, I mean, if you look and talk to citizens in the area, there's a strong interest in this history, not even with the 250th, but just in general. And granted, we don't have any colonial Revel War forts or British encampments that we could, I mean, British actual history, we have later history, but there's a strong, strong interest in our area.
Walter, how do folks get involved? I'll let you on the organizational side talk a little bit about how people can learn more, how can they get involved. I don't think you have to do the genealogy you have to do for DAR if you want to be a reenactor, right?
Pretty much a reenactor is anyone who is willing to do the effort to acquire the uniform, join us, come out. We'll train you in the period drills and things like that. I know that because I'm the British sergeant normally in my 43rd uniform, but I dressed up a little different.
You're always losing the war, Walter. That must get old.
Perspective. It's all perspective. Because in the 18th century, I didn't know I was losing.
Yeah.
I was the conquesting empire.
Well, that's good. So you got to have, you have to kind of internalize. You're actors really, aren't you?
Yes. Yeah. Frustrated actors.
Yeah.
Yeah. But with a strong, strong interest in history and trying to portray it. I mean, living history, that's what that's all about.
But I thought your comment about having to, I'm not just a guy who's losing a war. I think I'm the empire of the world.
So when we do our living history events, we each take on a persona. And in my persona, I play a British soldier. I play a non-commissioned officer. So I go into that mindset.
With a little attitude, maybe.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. That's easy. A lot of attitude.
It's easy to come by for some of us. But but it's also to draw the crowd in and also to make it fun. Mm-hmm. And while we're trying to teach history, we're not lecturing. We're trying to show what a living history is and how that certain aspects might have been influenced. And also just a snippet of the time period.
Some context.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because we don't have the hundreds of people. Like, I reenacted back east during the American Revolution as a youth and as a young adult. And we would have hundreds to thousands of reenactors. Out here, we don't have the numbers. So what we have to do is we have to convey as best we can to the public and give them a sense of what things were like.
And Dennis Walker, back up the line here. You guys are actually looking for people, right?
We are always looking for people that want to portray this historical era. We help them first by introducing them to what we do. Eventually, they get their own. We do have, occasionally, we have loaner gear, but most of the time, at some point, we ask them to buy their own stuff.
But your website, and give that out, if you would, when you answer here, but you said you're looking specifically, I think, for, like, camp support personnel, followers, some of the people, you know, it wasn't just the troops. There was this whole support system that had to move with them.
That is completely true. We're looking for skills and crafts. We have a candle maker. We look for blacksmiths. We have, like, I'm working on a soap making using tallow. Just things of the period. We do cooking. My wife, who's in there, does cooking demonstrations. And so we do lots of different, we're always looking for that skill.
Right.
I mean, that's an interest. That's what the people want to see.
Yeah.
Not just battle and firing muskets. But
as cool as that may be,
as cool as that may be, they definitely want to see what were people doing in those days.
Yeah.
How did they live? I mean, up to a point, you know, we can only do so much.
Renee, back to you. I'll let you talk a little bit now about becoming a member of DAR. It's not just, hey, I've got this. This sounds fun and a nice group of ladies. Maybe true, but it doesn't mean you're getting in. So talk a little bit about how that works and how somebody can figure that out.
Well, you do your research in your through your ancestry, and if you can find a direct line back to a patriot that has been proven and recorded as a patriot we call them patriots, but they can be soldiers, they can be someone who gave aid, who gave supplies.
But you need some paperwork,
you
right?
You need some paperwork. But you do, you direct your line back to that person through your lineage, and then you apply. We have an incredible genealogy group of women that do the research. Some of them are professional people that look at our applications at the end and certify it. So,
gotcha.
So we all are certified. And
in our last 2 minutes here, because I want to make sure we get this in, talk a little bit about what's coming. We're taping this here in the fall of 2025. Talk a little bit about what the calendar looks like for each of you in our last 2 minutes coming into 2026.
Yes, and this isn't new for us, by the way. We've been working on all of this.
Yeah.
I mean, it's every year we do this kind of thing. Yeah. The DAR has been working on the America 250 celebration for about 5 years now.
Oh,
we're
yeah.
in our fourth year getting into it. So it's going to be ramping up. Every year we have been doing things. We just finished up doing, my chapter did a fight, we're at the Washington State Fair doing 4 days there on America 250 and history, and we even dressed up in colonial gear at some time. But there is so many things happening throughout the state, and the best way to find out what's going on, because there's 35 chapters, every single chapter is working on something in their communities, and is to go to wadar.org. That's our state organization.
Perfect.
They have the list of chapters on that website, and you can find one in your neighborhood, you can find one in your town, and find out what they're doing.
Dennis, I imagine you guys are probably doing 364 out of 365 days next year, right?
We're killing time, definitely, trying to figure out how we do this correctly and celebrate. I mean, we're already, this would be 250 to 1775.
Yeah.
So if you think back through history, what happened before the Declaration of Independence.
We're building
That's the major event, but... Yeah. To form the country, but there's all kinds of stuff going on 250 years ago today.
Right. Mm-hmm. For the next year, though, how do things look like they're rolling out, Walter? Is it monthly, and where can folks go to find out if they want to see what you guys do?
So we are finalizing our calendar right now.
Okay.
But it will be posted on the website, which is Spirit of 76 Living History Association. If you Google that, you will find, Google is an English term,
it came from London or something. Or I don't know.
You will find her. Hey, I got to do my best.
What if the Brits had Google?
but no, you'll find all the information. We're very transparent about what we put up there. We you know, try to keep communications open and available to everyone at all times. And it really is also a family type organization.
Yeah.
So, you know, I may play a bad guy and do my best Darth Vader, but but it's a lot of fun to get into persona.
Yeah.
And it's a lot of fun. And I also go as a colonial for certain events, like when we do parades or things.
When you're tired of losing, yeah.
Well, yeah.
Great conversation, guys. I appreciate it. It is going to be a heck of a year, and I appreciate you giving us a little insight into what you're doing for 1776, 2026. Correct. Thank you.
Correct.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You know, we've lived through worse times. 87 years after the signing of the Declaration of Independence, President Lincoln was at Gettysburg and asked that we honor the Civil War's dead by ensuring that, quote, government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from this earth. The bottom line, we all have to fight for the middle ground and somehow cling to the idea that there is more that unites us than divides us.